This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The white South African novelist André Brink has been praised and damned in his country. He won South Africa's most prestigious literary award 3 times, but 2 of his novels were censored by the government. In fact, Brink's 1974 novel, Looking on Darkness, was the first novel written in the Afrikaans language to be banned by the government. Afrikaans is considered the language of apartheid and the ruling class, but it's also Brink's native tongue. He wrote about becoming an Afrikaner dissident in his book Writing in a State of Siege, a collection of his essays from 1967 to 82. His novel A Dry White Season was adapted into a film of the same name featuring Marlon Brando. Brink's new novel, An Act of Terror, is about 2 Afrikaners who plan to assassinate the president of South Africa. Brink told me why he wanted to get into the minds of assassins.
I think it was the experience in the course of the 80s of getting closer and closer to a number of people within the ANC, which, as you know, is the main liberation movement in South Africa. I made some of my very, very best friends among them. And this meant having the experience of getting very close to people who at one or other stage in their lives, even if now perhaps they were professors of literature or scholars of music or whatever, had been what the world outside would call terrorists, had actively been involved in violence. And it seemed to me, as a white South African moving among quite a variety of whites, that it was just so easy to brand a person a terrorist without really understanding the forces and motives which drive a person to such an extreme. So I wanted to try and find out for myself what could happen inside a person to drive him or her to that point where he or she believes that violence is simply the only option, and in the process to try and interpret some of these truly wonderful and memorable people to others who did not have the occasion of meeting them personally.
Why did you make your assassins white?
I think it was important for me for a variety of reasons. First of all, to get across to, in the first place, to a number of my own South African compatriots, that violence is not something you associate only with them, with the blacks, with the so-called enemy, that even ordinary, decent, white Christian Afrikaners can reach a point where they believe that violence is the only option. And being white myself, I have a more direct line of communication, as it were, to a white community. And it seemed to me very important to try and reach those people and interpret to them something of what I was privileged to glimpse of the so-called other side.
Have you ever reached the point where you felt you were ready to participate in an act of violence?
I think I've often reached the point where I could deeply understand why people resorted to violence, but I don't think I could ever do it.
Why not?
I'm simply not good enough material for that. I don't have the steel nerves that that are required for something like that. And perhaps I have always remained, even in the very dark days, something not of an optimist, but not entirely a pessimist, which means that it has always seemed to me that in addition to the possibility of violence, there have always been other possibilities. And to me, it seemed imperative that one exhaust everything first before taking that ultimate step.
One of your main characters' fathers is a lawyer. Your father was a magistrate. I wonder what kind of attitude you grew up with toward upholding the laws of apartheid.
I think it was very ambiguous. On the one hand, I grew up in a very traditional, very conservative Afrikaner family in a series of very small villages where attitudes were absolutely as conservative as one could imagine, like the Deep South in America. And, of course, my father, as a magistrate, had to uphold the system. But being born inside it, as a child, even as a student, before I went to Paris and started looking at the world through different eyes, I never really deeply or significantly tried to question the system, because I'd never been exposed to any other possibility. At the same time, perhaps, I was fortunate in at least having a father who, even if he had to uphold the system and did do just that, also had an innate sense of justice. He is still one of the most just people I've ever encountered. And I think in both respects, this has fed my own interests and tendencies.
What are the pressures on a just man upholding an unjust system?
Oh, they're awful. I don't think my father himself was so conscious of these pressures because, terrible to say, he believed that it was a just system. He believed in the the fact that whites were the only civilized people. At the same time, he didn't want to be unjust to the black victims of that system. But I don't think he ever really felt a conflict about that because he believed that apartheid was trying to keep people apart so that each could best fulfill his or her own aspirations. And it's, I think, very hard for many Afrikaners who never have had any exposure to a world beyond that to realize just the enormity of the evil of apartheid. I myself had to leave the country for a few years and live in Europe in order to suddenly discover the full horror of what is being perpetrated there.
When you did discover the horror of apartheid, what kind of split, if any, did that cause in your relationship with your father?
There were enormous consequences. The splits and the breakups really occurred with my friends. With my family, on the whole, we went through a very difficult period. But the love we had within the family relationship in the long run was strong enough to overcome our political differences simply by tacitly agreeing that we would never discuss politics at home.
But with your friends, things were never reconciled?
No, there were some of them who totally rejected me and refused ever to speak to me again, and some of them who chased me out of their homes and forbade me ever to set foot in them again. And that was quite hard because some of them had been very good friends before.
You said it was in Paris that you were awakened to the true meaning of apartheid. Was there a moment of revelation for you? Was it a slower process than that?
I think the main moment had to do with the Sharpeville massacre in 1960. Because of the extreme violence of it and the ripple effects it sent right across the world, and the fact that I wasn't home, I wasn't cushioned or sheltered by all the traditional defense mechanisms, but was exposed to many of my new friends there who viciously turned against me as a South African, as if I were co-responsible for what was happening. And that forced me in a very short time to revisit all the positions I'd taken, to reassess everything I'd always taken for granted. So it was a very profoundly disturbing, but in the long run, very, very rewarding experience.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andre Brink. He's a South African writer whose new novel is called An Act of Terror. You were, as I said, the first Afrikaner writer to have a book censored. Was the Afrikaner establishment reluctant to censor one of its own?
For a long time they were. For a long time, I think Afrikaner writers enjoyed a specially privileged position because, however recalcitrant they might be, they were still regarded as members of a family. But once the government had taken that decisive step of acting against one of their so-called own writers, the hunt was open. And then we really had a very, very raw deal. And we discovered gradually that English writers like Nadine Gordimer and others actually had more freedom to express themselves than most Afrikaans writers had because they were regarded as English, therefore as part of the traditional enemy. So what else could one expect of them but attacks? But if attacks came from within the establishment itself, that was really viewed in a very, very harsh light.
What were some of the personal ways that sense of betrayal was expressed to you?
I think it was mainly in the form of a persistent persecution by the security police, because once a book is banned, it's not just the terrible discovery that you are, if you write in a small language like Afrikaans, cut off from your whole readership and therefore are left in the wilderness. But the security police regard you as a subversive element, and it's very much like the dark years of the McCarthy era in America. You are constantly being followed wherever you go. From time to time, you called in to be interrogated by the security police, or they suddenly turn up and start searching your house. At one stage, they confiscated even my typewriters to make it difficult for me to type. The whole exercise was focused on making life as difficult as possible in order to intimidate one.
Your first censored book was Looking for Darkness, published in 1974. Did the government give you any sense of what specifically offended them?
Oh, they threw the whole censorship book at me. They said it was subversive, in political terms, aimed at overthrowing the government, and they said it was pornographic, and they said it was blasphemous. Those were the three major counts. Every time a character in the book said, "Oh God, it's hot," or something like that, that was noted down as being blasphemous. And it's weird in retrospect, but it was damn serious right then.
Afrikaans is considered the language of apartheid. How has it affected your feelings about the language? You know, most writers have such a deep affection for the language that they grew up speaking.
That was very difficult at times, because it is my mother tongue, and it is really a marvelous vehicle for expressing oneself in, because it is still so young, it's vital, it's not fossilized in its specific forms yet. You can really sit down and do almost anything with it. But at the same time, I was very, very aware of this political stigma attached to it. But perhaps for that very reason, even though I switched to writing in English alongside of Afrikaans, I never stopped writing in Afrikaans in order to prove that it is not just the language of apartheid, of oppression, of the establishment, but that it can be used by people fighting for liberation, fighting to assert their own individuality through that very language. And I think it has paid off. Nowadays, there are more and more of the so-called coloured people in South Africa who also use Afrikaans as their language of revolution and rebellion, and there are more and more of the coloured writers using Afrikaans, and they are revitalizing it in a wonderful way.
That's interesting. So what have you been doing for the last few years? You write in both Afrikaans and English?
Yes. Initially, after the ban on Looking on Darkness, it was a matter of writing in Afrikaans and then translating. But gradually, the dual process of writing in two languages has become part of my whole method of operating as a writer. Nowadays, I write in both. I write some chapters in one language and some in another. In An Act of Terror, where I have a variety of different speakers, I used Afrikaans for some of them and English for others. I wrote the historical section, which forms about a fifth of the book, in English, and much of the rest in Afrikaans, except, as I've said, for some of the different voices speaking. And it gives me a kind of linguistic interaction among the characters, which, of course, in the final version, one cannot communicate. But I think something of it still gets through.
Kind of doubles your work, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Doubles, trebles, quadruples. But I think it adds, I hope it adds to it in the long run, simply by forcing me to think through everything I say in at least two different languages. And that makes sure that one approaches the kind of clarity you wish for, perhaps a bit more closely than would have been the case otherwise.
If you're just joining us, my guest is South African writer Andre Brink. His new novel is called An Act of Terror. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is South African novelist Andre Brink. How is the gradual ending of apartheid changing your place as a writer in South Africa?
In one way, it makes it more difficult. In another, it makes it easier. More difficult in the sense that, ironically perhaps, when you're living in a situation of overt, direct oppression, there is a sense of meaning to what one does. It may be very difficult sometimes to operate, but it gives you that sense of adventure, of doing something which is worthwhile doing. When that pressure eases, and when one's way of working as a writer becomes more and more comparable to the way of working of any writer anywhere else in any free society of the world, then there is that much less reason for readers to take heed of what one is saying, because it's just one book among many others. So that drama of the interaction lessens. And that may be a negative. On the other hand, it may be healthier. One sometimes tends to overstate a case when you are shouting against a blank wall. Now it seems to me that as a result of the changes happening, South African literature generally is opening up, is widening its spectrum. More things can be said about more experiences. One need not feel, not that I think any writer really worthwhile has yielded to that temptation. But one needn't feel obliged to transmit a message, as it were. You can simply write about, you can write a love story, you can write about anything that interests you, and it is a valid part of human experience. I think that is wonderful. People outside seem to have become used to expecting South African writers to write about apartheid, and that can be a deadening kind of expectation. If one can really write about anything in the human condition, that is wonderful. And that is what has always interested me. I don't regard myself as a political writer, just as little as I think Nadine Gordimer or Ethel Fugard regard themselves as political writers. Politics has formed part of what we do because it is part of our daily lives. It enters the fabric of our existence. But what interests me is what happens to a particular woman, man, child in a specific historical situation. And with apartheid slowly receding, those human experiences can hopefully now be evaluated for what they are.
Well, your new novel, An Act of Terror, is still a political novel. It's still largely about apartheid and two people trying to bring down the system. Do you see a change in your writing coming up?
I was very conscious while I was writing through the nearly 8 years when I was engrossed in this book of not only an era in South African history drawing to a close, but of a certain phase in my own writing coming to an end, too. I know that something new is going to happen. I can't define it yet. I'm not into another book yet. I need some time to catch my breath again after the many years working on this one. But I know it's going to be different. The circumstances outside, and I suppose a number of things which have happened inside me, just clamor for something new.
What are some of the ways your day-to-day life has been changing as the apartheid system changes or draws to a gradual close?
I think mainly the fact that, especially throughout the 70s and much of the 80s, when it became known, and as it became known, that I was a dissident writer, that I was fighting in my books against apartheid, more and more of the oppressed, black people, became aware of that. Many of them hadn't even read my books, but they just knew my name as somebody who was fighting against apartheid. And so they would literally come to me for help. If a member of their family had been arrested by the security police, they would come to me to offer some kind of assistance. Or very often, sometimes, simply when somebody was thrown out of his or her house for not being able to pay the rent, they would come to me. So every single day of my life went into trying to help people like this or to put them in touch with people who could help. And now gradually, with that urgency disappearing slowly, and also with the appearance of organizations like the ANC and others who are tuned to doing that kind of job, it leaves me more free time to pursue my writing. And that is, it was worthwhile being involved in that daily contact with people, but sometimes it was very, very exhausting. And I think this respite may also help my writing.
As the system changes, do you find that your relationship with black South Africans is changing at all?
I think that has become more varied, as it were, because there are more areas in which we can communicate and work together. It is not just in the sense of working together against apartheid. We can simply share that much more as friends. It is easier sometimes simply to sit down and listen to music or watch a play or just talk nonsense, just talk as ordinary human beings do when they get together. So that, in addition to the continuing struggle, because not for a moment must one think that with apartheid slowly leaving the scene, the problems in the country are being solved. So there is still a real sense of a struggle continuing, but at the same time, there is a larger scope for ordinary human interaction on the most banal and the most warm and the most ordinary levels. And that is very rewarding.
I have met some writers who felt a responsibility to stay in South Africa to fight the system. They would have felt like they were walking out on it. if they had left the country. I wonder if that's what keeps you in South Africa, or if there were other things that have been keeping you there, and if you've ever thought about moving someplace else.
It's a very complicated question, really. As far as those who have left the country are concerned, some of them had no choice. Most of the black writers were driven into exile. Some, like the and some white writers, like the poet Brayton Breytenbach, whose wife was regarded as coloured because she was Vietnamese and wasn't allowed into South Africa. He also had no choice. But if one had the choice, to me it seemed, and others may have seen it differently, but to me it seemed absolutely important to be on the spot in order to live through what was happening, in order to experience that solidarity with people there who did not have the option of leaving, and to report from the inside, as it were. Oh, there were days when I really thought that there was no point in staying. I'd always taken the view that if the lives of the members of my family were physically in danger to such a point that it was necessary to get out, then I would have to leave. But for as long as it was possible to remain there and to write there where things were happening, it was imperative for me to stay there. Now, of course, the choices are much more open. It wouldn't so matter so much to the developing South African situation whether I'm there or not. But it is so fascinating to be there, to be in the midst of a society which is in the process of redefining itself, of looking for itself, trying to discover who it is and what it can be, that I don't want to leave now. But if one day the attraction of the south of France, which has always been one of my favorite Elysian fields, as it were, becomes so great, then I may leave without a sense of betrayal.
Well, André Brink, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
André Brink's new novel, An Act of Terror, is published by Summit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.